Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for November 4th, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
In Taiwan, 37% of 12-year-olds had myopia in 1983, compared to 61% in the year 2000.
We generated seven different kinds of bacteria, all of which produce a different fluorescent protein, meaning that when they grow, they generate a fluorescent signal when you shine light on them.
Optical pacing would be minimally invasive, genetically targeted, spatially and temporally precise, and delivered remotely.
This week, a pacemaker that restarts the heart with light and a secret code made from fluorescent bacteria. Also, could a lack of outdoor activity be making kids more nearsighted? But first, basic intelligence has generally been thought to be innate and unchanging. But as correspondent Justin Warner learned, there's new research suggesting this might not be the case.
It's long been thought that your IQ doesn't change much over time, but maybe not, according to cognitive neuroscientist Kathy Price of the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London. She explains that this belief is based largely on group studies.
What people have done is to take a population of people and then test them at different time points in their life and show that there's a highly significant correlation between how they perform at one time and how they perform at another time. So, for example, if you had an average IQ of 110 at aged 10 and then again at aged 80, then that would look as if that sample hadn't changed their IQ.
She and her colleagues looked at individuals. They tested 33 healthy teenagers at age 14 and again at 18. Many of their IQ scores went significantly up or down on the verbal or nonverbal subtest or both. Price says there were many possible explanations for the inconsistency.
The reason we were able to say that something meaningful was going on was because we had brain scans on the individuals at both time points. And we were able to show that the degree to which their scores had changed over the four-year period matched the degree to which parts of their brain had changed.
Kids with better scores had somehow increased the density of the nerve cells called gray matter in brain areas that were relevant to the subtest they improved on. The next question is whether these changes were biologically predestined or the result of what the teenagers did or didn't do during the four-year gap.
Thanks, Justin. Next, Suzanne Bard investigates a possible link between our modern lifestyle and an increase in the rate of nearsightedness in children.
Myopia, or nearsightedness, makes distant objects appear blurry. And over the past few decades, it's become much more common, especially across the industrialized world.
In Taiwan, 37% of 12-year-olds had myopia in 1983, compared to 61% in the year 2000.
This has left scientists puzzled, since the condition has long been known to run in families. So Cambridge epidemiologist Justin Sherwin and his colleagues analyzed eight studies of myopia that looked at over 10,000 children. They found that kids were 2% less likely to develop myopia for each extra hour they spent outdoors each week.
We think that there are certainly environmental factors consistent with a change in lifestyle that have brought about the increase in the rates of myopia.
He says the analysis doesn't prove a causal link between a lack of outdoor activity and an increase in nearsightedness, but it is consistent with a recent interventional study in China showing that nearsighted children who spent an average of 2 hours a day outside developed better vision than those who didn't.
Thanks, Suzanne. About 500,000 people die each year in the U.S. because of cardiac rhythm problems. That's why many people wear pacemakers that reset the heart electrically. But these require invasive surgery, aren't very precise, and can't be used around strong magnets, among other shortcomings.
The problem with electrical pacing is that the signal is really strong and it kind of kills the surrounding cells. Also, it's very difficult to locate it very precisely. And the most important problem is that the electrical pacing sits directly on the heart.
That's Stanford bioengineer Ellen Cool. She and graduate student Oscar Abelez are designing what they say will be a better pacemaker, one that uses light instead of electricity to make heart muscles contract.
Optical pacing would be minimally invasive, genetically targeted, spatially and temporally precise, and delivered remotely.
Abelez says they've genetically engineered heart muscle cells that are sensitive to light.
We introduce a light-sensitive protein into the cells, and then when we stimulate these proteins with a specific wavelength of blue light. This light leads to a cascade of events, eventually causing the individual cells to contract and, at a bigger level, the whole heart to contract.
He says yellow light can then be used to turn off the cells. Kuhl says light-based pacemakers of the future could consist of tissue patches made from a patient's own stem cells so they wouldn't be rejected.
As an engineer, I think we're all inherently interested in creating, building, and testing things. And doing that with biological tissues or biological cells is, of course, even more exciting. And then while doing this, helping people to obtain a better lifestyle, I think is just amazing. And so it's been really a great and fun project. We actually hope that it will improve life and longevity for the millions of people that suffer from arrhythmias.
Next, Suzanne says scientists are developing an E. coli code.
Heard of snail mail? Well, now there's bacteria mail. Researchers at Tufts University have devised a way to send coded messages by inserting jellyfish genes into harmless bacteria. Chemist David Walt explains.
We generated 7 different kinds of bacteria, all of which produce a different fluorescent protein, meaning that when they grow, they generate a fluorescent signal when you shine light on them. The code is just a combination of 2 colors. So we have 7 different colors, and so with a 2-color combination of 7 different colors, we can generate 49 different symbols. And what we did is we assigned each of those 49 combinations to a letter, a number, or a symbol, like the @ in your email address. And that code then is kind of what you do when you're a kid. You send messages. You assign numbers to each letter, and then you can decode it by just looking up what the numbers are, and that then spells out a particular message.
Walt says the messages can only be read by receivers who have the correct growth medium, a sort of biological decoder ring.
So the sender of the message and the receiver of the message need to agree beforehand what that particular growth medium is going to be. And so that's the way the secret is kept, because if you grow it in something that does not contain the right combination of materials, you get a signal that doesn't make sense or gibberish.
While this form of communication might sound less efficient than email, Walt says secret messages sent this way would be much harder to hack. The bacterial codes could also be used as an alternative to digital barcodes to deter counterfeiting. And then there's also the visual appeal of using glowing jellyfish proteins to create a secret code.
You know, one of the things about science that appeals to people is it's visually appealing, whether you're, you know, looking under a microscope at bacteria or at the wing of a fly or collecting insects or looking through a magnifying glass at the wing of a butterfly, looking at crystals forming. To me, this is just a very visually appealing research project because it's very colorful. You can see the result develop literally in front of your eyes. You know, to me, that was really, I'd say, the most exciting part, just seeing these messages develop and kind of bringing me back to my childhood.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, could predators be literally scaring dragonflies to death? And why one insect pest's mating habits could lead to its downfall? Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.